From KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Jay Barron. Coming up this week, the Sitka tribe would like to see changes to how herring are managed. Part of the blob, let's call it Blob Junior, had some significant effects on Kachemak Bay the last few years. And we find out how Fish and Game is coping with the ongoing budget cuts in the face of the state's current fiscal crisis. All that and more coming up on the Alaska Fisheries Report.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. 1-800-992-4960 or online at alaskaboat.com.
Commercial fisheries in southeast Alaska have survived 2 years of state budget cuts, but not without some changes. In response, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Division of Commercial Fisheries has cut some positions, ended some monitoring programs, and found some new funding sources. KFSK's Angela Denning tells us more about how the department is coping.
When the state cuts are listed on a spreadsheet, the individual amounts don't seem that staggering. $20,000 here, $50,000 there. But it totals about $1.75 million over the last 2 years. The cuts include laying off a part-time front desk person in Petersburg, not replacing a retired analyst programmer, and eliminating a position in the Golden King Crab fishery. Those are just some of the cuts these past 2 years.
None of them were good, of course.
That's Lowell Fair, the regional supervisor for commercial fisheries in Southeast. He says the Golden King Crab job was an observer who would collect data on the crab in season. But the position didn't provide the most critical information for managing the fishery. And the Golden King Crab fishery is tiny anyway, compared to the Dungeness and the Tanner Crab fisheries. So it got the axe.
You know, when we go to cut budgets, we're always looking for the one that has the cut that has the least impact on what we do.
Similarly, the division trimmed down its herring stock assessment programs in the region by $142,000, keeping only the two main areas, Sitka and Craig.
Our goal is to maintain the most important fisheries, the biggest fisheries, you know, the most valuable fisheries. That's usually the way we go, is try not to affect those.
Some of the Southeast cuts were replaced with other funding sources like grants. About a $200,000 cut for tracking coho returns was fully replaced by money through the Pacific Salmon Commission. But in some cases, the state has found itself deeper into the business side of fisheries. Take the aerial salmon surveys, for example. In season, biologists fly multiple times a week to observe fish spawning in the Clear Mountain streams and monitor fishing effort by counting boats. Southeast's aerial salmon surveys have seen cuts of just over $130,000 the last 2 years. To make up the difference, the state is using more test fisheries. The program allows the state to hire a fisherman to catch fish and then split the profits with the state. Test fisheries have been used in the past for a variety of fisheries to not only bring in revenue, but to gain data on some of the fish in specific areas.
And this would be an additional test fishery. The main purpose is to get revenue so that we can manage the fishery.
Paying for the aerial surveys by way of the fish may sound reasonable, but there is some baggage. It creates competition.
And that puts hardship on the fishermen because, in a sense, we're taking those fish from the fishermen.
The same thing happened with a $50,000 cut to the state's black cod assessment program. The legislature gave the department authority to get the money from test fishery sales. And while it might not be popular with some fishermen, Fair says the alternative could mean less fishing.
We can't go and fly aerial surveys for salmon, for example, and we're not sure how many fish are really spawning in these rivers. Well, we want to be conservative, so we're going to probably not fish as much to make sure that we're getting enough fish in these rivers for sustainable run down the road, and that just means that there's less harvest opportunity for the fishermen.
Overall, the cuts to commercial fisheries in Southeast the last 2 years haven't been debilitating for Fish and Game, but Fair says that future cuts would be a concern.
Right now, we've cut about as much as we can cut without having serious impacts on any fishery. So any future cuts really digs into our ability to manage efficiently.
So far, the fiscal year budget for 2018 proposed by Governor Walker does not have many cuts for commercial fisheries in Southeast. Fair says it's encouraging, but it will be up to the legislature to keep it that way. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
The Sitka Tribe of Alaska wants to see more protection for subsistence harvesters when herring season begins this month. The tribe's herring committee is recommending a pair of proposals to reserve more area for subsistence and to cut the commercial harvest by half. KCAW's Emily Russell tells us more.
Just a few weeks from now, Sitka Sound will flood with commercial seiners and subsistence users, all in search of one small fish, herring. Commercial seiners harvest herring whole and strip the valuable sacrel from the females. At the same time, subsistence users submerge hemlock branches in the water, which become coated with eggs as the fish spawn. But Sitka Tribe of Alaska's Director of Resource Protection, Jeff Feldpouch, says success rates for subsistence, they're down.
We're seeing a change in the herring as to how they spawn, where they spawn, and it's making it much more difficult for subsistence harvesters to meet the ANS, or the amount necessary for subsistence.
Feldpouch was speaking at the tribe's most recent herring committee meeting. He says subsistence needs have only been met half the time in recent years, with 2016 considered one of the poorest subsistence harvests in memory. From what he's heard, Feldpouch says it wasn't always this hard to fill your freezer.
You know, back in the 80s or earlier in the fishery, there really wasn't an issue with getting your eggs. And as this biomass has grown, you would think that it would be even easier, but it's becoming more and more difficult.
The biomass, or how much herring are in the water, has fluctuated a lot since the 1980s. Estimates from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game show spawning biomass ranging between 18,000 tons and 103,000 tons in the last couple of decades. Fish and Game forecasts a total biomass of 73,000 tons for 2017.
The 2017 biomass is a forecast that has no scientific proof.
Tribal citizen Tom Gamble says Fish and Game's forecast model is outdated, that they're just guessing. He told the members of the herring committee he's worried that if the spawn biomass is overestimated, subsistence users will lose out. But Eric Coonrad is confident in the forecast model.
There's going to be skeptics out there, but the data is solid. The methods are solid.
Coonrad is Fish and Game's area management biologist for Sitka. The fishery is managed based on a detailed model that accounts for the distribution, size, and age of the herring, and on the success of the annual spawn. Calculations on the size of the 2017 biomass began last year. Daily aerial surveys get the length of the spawn, and dive surveys get the depth of the spawn. The tribe's herring committee is drafting two proposals to the Board of Fish. The first would close off certain areas to commercial fishing, including Cat Leanne Bay, Alakina Bay, and Nakwasita Sound. The second proposal asks the Board of Fish to reduce the guideline harvest level, or how much commercial seiners are allowed to catch, to 10% of the total spawning biomass. That's compared to the typical 20%. The tribe's herring committee plans to review these draft proposals at its next meeting, March 6th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Russell.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard-accepted, hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amse.org or 907-747-3287.
Since late 2013, a large mass of warm water nicknamed the Blob has dominated the Gulf of Alaska. But those elevated temperatures weren't confined to outside waters. Last winter, Kachemak Bay near Homer saw a similar pattern of unusually warm water. Now researchers believe those temperature spikes were linked to last year's common muir die-off. KBBI's Shayla Farzon tells us more.
The sea can be a vast and mysterious thing, but oceanographers make it their business to understand what's happening beneath the surface. Chris Holdreed is the director of NOAA's Kositsna Bay Laboratory near Homer. She's part of a team of researchers involved in a long-term ecosystem monitoring project called Gulf Watch Alaska. Since 2012, Holdreed has collected basic information about the water conditions in Kachemak Bay, like salinity, oxygen content, and temperature. She says the results from last winter were unusual, to say the least.
The water temperatures that we saw, instead of being in the mid to upper 30s, were in the low to mid 40s. So those are temperatures we typically see in June.
It appears to be part of a larger trend. In late 2013, a persistent high-pressure system allowed a huge patch of abnormally warm water to form in the Gulf of Alaska. 3 years later, the blob, as it's now become known, has yet to dissipate. And those warm water conditions are now thought to be affecting wildlife populations, both in and out of the water. Researchers now believe last year's common mer die-off was linked to increasing water temperatures. Volunteers counted about 46,000 dead mers in Alaska last year, but at least 500,000 may have died. Shannon Atkinson is a professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's one of the people trying to understand what caused the die-off.
The big question is why? What is going on that is resulting in this final sort of disastrous state of birds flying onshore or dying in large numbers?
Common mers look like a cross between a loon and a small penguin. Most died on shore over the winter, a time they normally would be feeding near the continental shelf, and they were in rough shape.
The birds were way underweight. The veterinary reports were that they were emaciated, and the cause of death was pretty much attributed to starvation.
Now, Atkinson and her colleagues believe they may have identified the reason why the mers starved. Wintertime trawl surveys conducted by the National Marine Fisheries Service near the continental shelf found that three of the fish species the mers typically eat, pollock, capelin, and eulachon, were absent.
At least in 2015, there were none of them. They had some of the lowest counts that were very close to zero, and so we know that the food wasn't there, and then we saw the birds dying.
So how does this relate to warm water temperatures in Alaska? Fish feed on tiny marine creatures called zooplankton. Cold water tends to favor big, fatty zooplankton species, while warm water promotes the growth of smaller zooplankton, which don't provide as much energy to the fish.
That's why we've been calling it the perfect storm, because it's not only that all these things are there, but the timing of them and the intensity of them came together in a way that, you know, had disastrous effects for these populations.
And although the die-off itself has slowed, the effects may be felt for quite some time. Heather Renner is a biologist with the Alaska National Maritime Wildlife Refuge. She visited common mer colonies during the breeding season last summer.
What we found really was birds not attending the colonies. They were in rafts offshore in the water. Very few laid eggs, and of those that did, they didn't attend them. Most were lost to avian predators, and I think there was about zero chick production in all the colonies I'm aware of in the Gulf of Alaska.
Normally, about 60% of common mers raise a chick. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzon.
Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by AK Teach, now enrolling K-12 homeschool students throughout the state of Alaska, creating partnerships that are flexible, family-friendly, and unique to your child. More information is available at AK Teach or at 907-942-0667.
And that's all for this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report. We had help from KFSK's Angela Denning in Petersburg, KCAW's Emily Russell in Sitka, and KBBI's Shayla Farzon in Homer. From KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.